Hi, guys. We want to thank our great sponsor, Legion M. They are the first fan-owned entertainment company. We love working with them. They create really incredible experiences for people. If you're someone who wants to feel like you own a piece and are a piece of the industry, it's a great way to do it. They do meetups all over the country. They have a really cool community going online. I cannot recommend them enough. Go to legionm.com for more information.
Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
You're listening to Maltin on Movies, and our guest today has just made his first film as star and director, and that would be Academy Award-nominated actor Greg Kinnear. Welcome, Greg.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Wow, I'm getting a huge, it's huge all ovation of us in here. My,
yes.
Hey,
yes.
If there's four people in a room and two of them are applauding... I feel like that's pretty solid.
That's better odds than I usually get, yes, so I'm very, very pleased with that. Thank
more,
you.
More important, though, I really like your film.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, thank you.
It's called Phil.
Yeah.
And it opens July 5th.
Yes.
In a theater here and there.
Theater here and there, and an iTunes station near you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which is where most films get seen now.
That's the way it goes.
Where
I
and
guess.
How most films. Well, even in the heyday of indie films and the network of specialized film theaters, an awful lot of movies never played, you know, three horse towns, five horse towns, 10 horse towns.
You had to have a lot more horses, you know,
right,
before
and,
you got
and,
anything.
And so even then, it was true that more people would tend to see it in some form of home
viewing.
On
IFC, right? Or one of those channels.
Yeah. That's true. That's true. And it is. I mean, I think the nature of, you know, independent film, and I've done a lot of it. It's you know, I obviously have had some experiences where, you know, a little Miss Sunshine or something like that, which just threads the needle, and mm-hmm. and it's in a theater everywhere, but
right.
That's very rare. And it's in this day and age, I'm just grateful I got to make the movie.
Yeah.
I'm incredibly grateful for that opportunity. You know, where I guess at the end of the day, whether you catch it in one of our theaters or whether you catch it at home, which happens more and more, I do like the cinema experience. It means something to me. It mm-hmm. has value to it. But, you know, it's 2019, Greg. Get over it.
I know, but it's hard to get over it. As a moviegoer, as a movie critic,
sure.
I feel the same way.
Yeah.
There is some weight to the idea of it opening in a theater. You want to be able to tell your friends, hey, you can go see it.
Sure.
You want to get reviewed in
yes.
the major media. And
you want, you know, we closed the Sarasota Film Festival a few months ago, and it was I don't know if you've been down there, but it's like an old opera house, about 800 mm-hmm. seats. And it was just so wonderful to hear mm-hmm. the movie. The movie has a lot of different turns, and it has some comedy in it, strangely enough, given its subject matter, and it certainly has some gaspy moments, but to hear mm-hmm. all those and hear the audience participate in that, you know, obviously.
It's alive.
Yeah, it's alive.
That's the difference.
And so there is something of value to that I think you don't get in the home experience. And yet, listen, I got three kids. It's hard for us to go out.
Yeah.
We are discovering wonderful films all the time at our house.
Well, people are always looking to my dad to trash Netflix streaming, whatever. And every time, especially because we've now done this show for a little while, the idea that I can tell one of my friends in England, hey, Greg Kinnear made this great film, you got to go watch it. And they can pull it up on their computer where they are and then talk to one of their friends
right.
who's traveling through Europe right now, wants something to watch. They go, oh, all right, hold on, pull it up. That is pretty incredible.
Right.
So while, yes, of course, I love, and also, you know, we love film festivals because
yeah.
that's what that's all about, is that you're with a whole bunch of people excited to see a movie. But at the same time, amazing that I can share something with someone anywhere in the world.
Completely.
And they can see it too.
Yeah, that viral nature of
yes.
movies now, that I can pass it to you, you can pass it to somebody else. You know, that's a different thing. And, you know, I've been through both incarnations, and, you know, it is just kind of the way that it is today. But there's plenty of good things about it to look to.
Yeah.
That
mm-hmm.
that is a good example.
So we're going to turn the clock back and look at some other films you've made. But I want to stick with Phil just for the moment. How did it come about? You star in it. and you directed it, and you're the executive producers. Yeah. No film has fewer than six executive producers now.
Right. You're not doing
it right. It's the law.
Yes, exactly.
but how did it come about?
It came about a producer, Sandy Stern, was the one who brought me the script. And, you know, I had, with my agent over the years, kind of expressed an interest in directing if I could find the right material. And I actually had found a couple of scripts along the way, and we did table readings, which I know that just sounds like, well, it's a table reading. But for me, it was a big deal
again,
to have a bunch
alive.
Of actors where I was like, hey, man, this is happening. This is real here. And yet on those experiences, I never felt – I just never could convince myself that I was – deeply vested in the story and that I was, you know, really feeling it. And so I just kind of waited and I went about my life. And then, you know, this script written by Stephen Mazur, who had written Liar Liar and other great films, I read it and it did not have a Greek element now. Originally it was a Scottish element. But I don't do a Scottish accent, so I couldn't do that. And I read the script, and it touched on a subject, suicide, was kind of the backdrop of it. And yet it was somewhat of a life-affirming story about a guy who thinks he has nothing to live for, meeting a person who has what he thinks is everything to live for. That guy takes his life, and it becomes a mystery about why he did that. And he's trying to save himself in a way and in finding the answers, which seemed important. And the backdrop of it seemed important. And the fact that over the last 15 years, when you think of suicide and those numbers, how it's become epidemic seemed important. And there was just a lot about it that resonated with me. And I found the fact that there was comedy in it and some fun in it, in spite of the subject matter, intriguing to me. But I was scared as hell about pursuing that because, out of deference to people who have been through that experience or know people who have, it was a kind of a daunting thing to kind of go in there and say, what's the balance? How do we shape this movie and find a story about a guy getting to the other side on his own journey, but having to tiptoe through this kind of horrible, this kind of oppressive, you know, subject matter that is just hard to talk about and hard to deal with. But it's the elephant in the room these days, you know?
Yeah. So, but it's not a heavy film.
It's not. And I, you know, it's hard to talk about even as I'm doing this because invariably when you say the S word, you know, there's a shroud of heaviness that comes with that.
It's not at all flippant, but it is, as you say, about a guy who's living and questioning his life.
That's right.
And that's what really drives the film.
Right.
And you did a lot of smart things. You hired wonderful actors, Emily Mortimer, who we love, and Bradley Whitford. And
Luke Wilson, Robert Forster.
Robert Forster, who is the MVP in any movie made.
Always. And it case in point was this. I mean, he comes in and just kind of pops in and steals the whole damn thing and then hands everybody a mail opener. He kind of gives out his gifts to. Have you ever heard this before?
Mm-hmm. No.
He gives out gifts to everybody. And I heard this from other directors. He goes, Did you get a letter opener from him? And I was like, yes, I did. But he's wonderful, wonderful. And Luke Wilson and it was really
a whole lot of good people. And then you hired John Bailey.
Yes.
Who photographed you in As Good As It Gets.
That's correct.
As your cinematographer, also happens to presently be... Yeah.
Yes.
The president of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences.
I only shoot movies with presidents.
That's
right.
Yes. Wise. Yeah. Wise and, decisions. And Bob Forster.
Yeah.
Combo.
And one of my favorite composers, Rolf Kent.
Yes. Yeah.
He did score. So now.
Now I was very lucky. I mean, those were all wonderful people to get a chance to work with. The conditions were tough. You know, we didn't have a great deal of time and had to move fast. And, you know, I was blessed with this incredible crew, these wonderful actors, Jay Duplass as well. And yet I was burdened by Greg Kinnear, who was also in the movie.
Hate that guy.
But what are you going to do when it comes time to make the movie? If you at least in this case, I honestly think there's many actors that I would have loved to have directed to play Phil. Mm. Mm-hmm. I really would have enjoyed that because it really was, you know, very schizophrenic to kind of be in and out of directing and acting, because it wasn't like I just did a small role. I'm Phil, so there's that.
And the film is called Phil. This, yeah. Yes. Yeah. But that's something that we are consistently fascinated by this. I understand that someone else can stand behind the camera while you are in a scene. But as the director, I feel like it's so much. And of course it's trust, and you had great people with you, but yeah, that's something to say for both of us. We just think, holy cow,
you know, it's been going on for 100 years. Charlie Chaplin did it, you know, in the teens. Right up through Olivier, Orson Welles, you know, Clint Eastwood.
How you say right up through Olivier and Orson Welles?
You know, lots and lots of people have done it.
Well, Robert Redford, I know he did, you know, the wonderful film, his first film, where he won many Academy Awards.
Ordinary People.
But he also did this little movie after that called The Milagro Beanfield War, which was a beautiful, beautiful, very small movie. And I remember thinking, my God, this guy's, he's an actor. Mm. What's he doing here? And I realized, oh, he's just telling a story. And obviously he wasn't in those films, but you know, again, that issue of storytelling is, you know, what you're most tasked with as a director. And it is quite, you know, it is a burden. And then acting, and what am I supposed to be doing in the scene? What am I supposed to be feeling? That's a burden too. So it is, there's a reason. A friend of mine, Doc Rivers, has said, he's a coach of a basketball team, who he said, you know, there's a reason I'm on the bench, Greg. Mm-hmm. There is a reason that there's a separation of church and state here from actors and directors. And generally, you know, I support that separation, and have great respect for people who have done both. I didn't know what I was in for. Ignorance is bliss, and just kind of dove in, and we got through it, but couldn't have done it without the good people I had behind me.
Well, you had a great team, but you were the leader, and you did well.
Oh, thanks.
And he hates most people, so that's a solid.
Now, are you still being asked, after all this time, about being a talk show host who got into movies as if it was an accident?
I do get that, you know, that thing does, it follows you around. It will tend to follow you around, your talk show background, for some reason, if you were a taxi cab driver and now you're an actor, that's fine.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. If you were waiting tables, you know,
totally
that's
acceptable.
Fine. But if you were, you know, if there was a TS there behind you, then it's a little strange. But not, you know, I don't know. I mean, I used to be much more conscious of it, and I don't know how much really. First of all, nobody cares. I mean, everybody's busy. They got their lives. No one's really paying that attention, much attention to certainly Greg Kinnear's life. Maybe they hear, oh yeah, he did a talk show before. For some, I think it's interesting fact. I guess it's the truth about me. But I try not to think that is, you know, a giant elephant in the room when I'm kind of talking about my life or my career, just because it represents a relatively small piece.
Sure.
Of it.
But I guess the bigger question is, did you have a game plan? What was your goal when you were a kid? I know you worked in radio when you were very young.
Mm-hmm.
And
in Greece, no less.
Yeah.
Which is
where the Greek thing comes in your film.
That's right. I lived in Greece for a lot of years. I was there for 6 years. And I, you know.
Why?
My father's with the American Embassy.
There you go.
He is a spy who will drop into this chamber any moment now.
Perfect.
Take us all away. No. But I was there for quite a while, and there were seminal years. I finished high school there.
Oh, that's a big deal.
Right?
You finish
high school, right?
Yeah.
So it had a big impression on me. I don't know. I somewhere along the line, I certainly had a couple of great acting teachers in high school that made an impact on me. And I did some performing and I did a little acting and I was doing the radio show. So I guess it was kind of there. I went to college. I didn't know what I was going to do. And it was the trick was just not to be, apprehended by the authorities and end up in a prison somewhere. Fortunately, I kind of came out to L.A. and I found my way into a low-budget film company that was making movies not far from here. It was called Empire Pictures. Mm-hmm. It was run by a guy named Charlie Band, and I was just kind of a gopher. I was a guy who would get coffee and donuts for anybody who wanted it. I'd be yelled at a lot, as I recall. I had no skills, no skill set at all to be there. But they were making movies, and that was cool.
People who have seen some of Charles Band's movies would say they didn't have much of a skill set either. But we'll just leave that alone for now.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I don't know.
You got to learn somewhere.
You got to learn somewhere, and they were making what they were making. Ed Wood's one of my favorite movies of all time, and I don't know. I have to look back at Ed now, mm-hmm. of having seen that movie and think about that. We're all doing, being passionate, it trumps everything.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I don't think that there was cynicism around making our movies at Empire, even though they were called, movies like Space Sluts and The Slammer. Somebody's passionate about making that. Reanimator, that was our mm-hmm, Titanic. Mm-hmm. I don't know, working there, and then I got an opportunity. A buddy of mine was dating Justine Bateman, actually, who was on Family Ties. And Justine helped facilitate me getting an audition at MTV in New York. I didn't get the job, but I got a tape out of it. And that led to my first job, which is a host at a channel called Movie Time, which was E before it was E.
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
Wake up, audience. Wake up. We're still here.
But that's part
opens
what makes
another.
It,
Totally. I mean, listen, that led to me ending up doing Talk Soup at E, and it kind of ended up with literally an audition with Sidney Pollack for mm-hmm. a movie. So, it was a weird kind of roundabout way of getting where I got. To go back to your central question, Greg, did you have to do this? I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think I would have ended up with a car. I never had bumper stickers that said Born to Act all over the car or anything. I mean, I had a real interest in this business, and I wasn't sure where I fit in. I had nobody. I didn't know anybody here, and it's an intimidating world for a kid originally from Indiana coming here, and I didn't take the presumption that I would just, I'll go do films. That's what I'll do. I mean, that just was so crazy to me. So I just was trying to find myself into the orbit of this world a little bit and see what sort of hand I could find. And I was very lucky to, I found a couple of jokers in there.
Well, fellow Indianan Sidney Pollack,
yeah,
then gave you a good role.
This Indianan Greek kid.
Yeah.
Come on over.
The old, we call it the Indiana Mafia, quite frankly. We were rolling hard.
The Hoosier heavy hitters.
Hoosier. Don't make the man choke, please.
I'm sorry.
I didn't know Sidney was from Indiana. I went in meeting him. I had no idea.
And this is for his remake of Sabrina.
Right.
With Harrison Ford.
And I showed up there and he said,
"You're not Harrison Ford.
What the hell are you doing here?
Who are you, sir?"
No, he actually had me in because he couldn't believe anybody was from Logansport. I'm from a town smaller than Sydney, and mm-hmm. and he couldn't believe that. So he wanted to. I honestly just think he wanted to say, "Yeah, that's funny." And I thought that was as far as that meeting was supposed to go. He kept me around. He had me come back. I read some scenes with him, and then he ended up doing us. I wouldn't even call it a screen test. A guy showed up with a video camera and shot us. He was literally playing Sabrina, and I was playing my guy, and that was my first job as an actor.
Hell of a start.
Mm. Yeah.
Followed very quickly by As Good As It Gets.
Excuse me, Dear God.
That's right.
I'm a fan.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
I like Dear God. I think I've watched it on planes about 400 times.
Oh, okay.
There was a point when it was on often.
Yeah.
And it was like of the... Remember when there used to... Remember, kids, when there was like either a movie.
Yes.
How We Suffered. There was a movie, and then eventually there was maybe two or three.
Right.
You know, thrilling. I watched that film. It was also on TV all the time. So
yeah.
It was sort of this thing that just
like
kind
in
of...
Like the HBO
Yeah, it just
or
becomes
something.
A part of you.
Yes.
And I remember, I still think about it, and it makes me smile just because the concept of, you know... If you don't remember the movie, little kids, not even necessarily little, but... I immediately think of like kids writing to Santa.
Right.
This is a similar kind of a concept where people write to God. And it doesn't have to be, you can be religious, you don't have to be religious, it doesn't matter what you are. It's the idea that we all sort of just have a little hope in us that there's something out there. And
it's based on a true thing. There are letters to God written, and the post office would have a bin for them, and they kind of didn't know what to do with them, and the writer had seen that and was like, oh, well, there's an interesting idea.
Yeah.
So I honestly don't think I've seen that since I made it.
I've seen it enough for both of us.
Yeah,
fine.
You've covered me completely. I appreciate that.
It's still very sweet.
Oh.
And it's
I thought about Tim Conway, actually, who passed away this year. He's so wonderful, and I got to work with him in that. And he was such an incredibly... obviously talented through, you know, such an incredible career, but it was so fun to work with him. He was just made me laugh.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah.
That's a wonderful memory to have.
Yeah. And Gary Marshall, who we lost 2 years ago. Too,
it's been a bad couple of years, man.
And tough for the Dear God.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. For me and my friends who all watch it every night before we go to sleep, it's gotten a bit harder. No. And then you do this little film, fine, whatever, As Good As It Gets. Right. Who even cares?
No, this leads us to talking for just a minute about directors. Now, you've just directed your first film.
Yeah.
But you're dealing now in just a short space of time with Sidney Pollack, Gary Marshall, and then James L. Brooks, who directed you in As Good As It Gets. And you've gone on to work with Sam Raimi and Paul Schrader and, you know, a lot of really, you know, solid filmmakers. Do you think you were... intentionally or unconsciously, or maybe consciously, taking notes, soaking up some of what they gave you as an actor?
How spongy are you?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I certainly wasn't doing it literally. Mm-hmm. Like, I think if Quentin Tarantino, given the chance, probably literally would have had a diary that
he would have been jotting things down
and recording those. And I wasn't foolishly doing that. I just... but I did get to work with and have gotten to work with some wonderful people. And I do think that was certainly helpful in doing this film and in directing. I mean, you know, first of all, it takes the whole to work with a great director in a way gets, you know, kind of demystifies it a little bit because there are just simple facts that, you know, elements that you have to get through and to see great people who you admire dealing with those kind of, you know, those obstacles, those just daily obstacles of where are we going here? How are we, is this isn't working. The sound of this isn't working. The lighting, this lighting is terrible over there. The refrigerator is way too bright. Those shrubs look fake. Why is there a poster of a movie from 12 years before this moment right now? You go on and on. So you get to see guys who are incredible dealing with just those things that go wrong on a kind of a day-to-day basis. And then and then as far as just the great ones, how wonderful they were, at least my experience with me of finding, knowing when I was just being horrible, which is a good deal of the time, ladies and gentlemen, knowing when to say, ah, you're maybe doing it, you're looking for this, but isn't it more this? Mm. Oh, oopsie. So that is something that I don't think anybody can prepare you for that. I don't think studying a great director, mm-hmm. I've sat there and had moments where I thought, oh, well, should the scene supposed to be like this? And then learned, no, it's really not. It's supposed to be like this. And humbly adjusted. You know, it's not something then I get to take in my back pocket, at least specifically, and reapply to a scene that's not going well. But I do think that there's some element that, you know, just having the lovely, you know, gift of having been and worked with some really good people to say, ah, there was, you know, maybe there's some piece of this that I can pull from the deep recesses of my brain to help a moment out. But mostly I had such good people, I didn't have to do that. So it was just worrying about me more than anything.
Mm-hmm. I always think it's a bit like parents and kids, which is that as a kid you say, I'm never going to do this like this. In the same way you go, I'm going to be exactly like that. I want to take this thing that they do. And you sort of are, you know, the director's your parent and you're the kids and you're making something and now you're dad,
right?
And you're behind the camera and you're going, okay, I'm never going to speak to an actor like this, or I'm not going to let anyone step on my toes here. I'm going to be very firm. I'm not going to let them push, whatever it is. And it's definitely all part of the process.
It is. I mean, there's so much learning, you know, it's just, and you're dealing with a business where there are no absolutes in anything.
It's no science.
There's no right or wrong does not exist. And you know, I've seen it work on both ends. And you know, if you thought it was going to be a right, and it suddenly took a left, and and that could be on the release of the movie in terms of expectations.
Oh, yes.
It could be on the movie itself in terms of it just not working. It could be on a moment that you thought was so good and it didn't. I mean, this is the fight, is that all you can do is learn your story, really know your story. I had about a year with this script before I found myself on a set, and that was helpful. And I was obsessive about it. I mean, I read it way too many times and I worked with it and I really felt like I knew the story, so that at least I could let go of that element of it. I mean, I knew what moments I was trying to convey as we went along, but it still was many dark nights of the soul.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about acting then, let's switch gears for a moment. Tell us about acting in a scene with Jack Nicholson.
I can tell you there's a scene in his – I've only done one movie with him. He keeps calling. I can only do one, Jack.
God, Jack.
The scene in As Good As It Gets where I go to the door. He has taken my dog, Verdell, and he has thrown it down the chute. And I have just been informed of that from my art dealer, Cuba Gooding Jr., and I go next door and I want to handle that moment. And we shot it very early on. It was one of the first scenes that we did. And I knock on the door and I say, I know what you did to my dog. And he starts and says, do you know that I work for a living? And it becomes like a, I don't know, like a 1 minute run or maybe a minute and a half where he's dressing my character down would be the best way to describe it. And honestly, I had tears coming down my eyes when I shot that. You can still see my shoulder shaking a little bit because I was, first of all, it was just joyous because I was watching the greatest ballet. I was an inch away from his nose watching the greatest facial ballet I had ever seen in my life. I was watching the best Super Bowl you ever watched. I was watching the best movie you ever saw. I was watching the greatest wedding you have ever been to. All playing out on his face in just real time because it had been written so fabulously for him. And I just had to stand there and be on the receiving end of it. We did a few cutaways. And it was just kind of a great and kind of opening moment to kind of say, okay, this is what I'm going to be facing for the next 4 or 5 months of shooting. As we went on, I mean, he was, I can't say enough, I've said, he's very, very, was very nice to me, incredibly, made me feel very comfortable. And he was always professional, you know, he was incredibly clear on what he wanted to do. And him and Jim had obviously a long history of working together, and they both, you know, they had a great working relationship. We'd go into the scene and I don't know, I would just try to keep up, really. But he never told me he just always seemed like, I remember like in that scene where I was like being dressed down and I started mm-hmm. laughing, I went up to him, I said, Jack, I'm really sorry. I was kind of like, I was just enjoying it so much. And he goes, I just used it. And, you know, and I think that's the truth of him more than anything else. And is you have a guide there. There's when he's doing his thing, you know, everything's being used. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter what's happening. It just everything's being used.
Because he's had experience.
Mm.
Right.
He knows the game.
Right.
And he knows how to play it really, really well.
Right. Yeah. I saw, you know, and Alan, you know, Alan Arkin. And,
oh,
you know,
yeah, he's all right,
guys,
too. Yeah,
he's okay, too. you know, these guys who've been around for a while, it's just great. You're getting the benefit of their experience.
Mm. Yeah.
And working with them is, you know, it's a gift.
Mm-hmm. Which plugs another movie that you're in, right. The Gift, with Sam Raimi's film, with a killer cast.
Mm. Yeah.
Killer.
God, but truly, who isn't in that movie?
Yeah.
It's
one of the first, if I'm remembering, that was one of the first times Katie Holmes had a darker playing. I mean, I'm of the age where I'm a Dawson's Creek kid. I grew up with that, right. And that's how I know her. And that was one of the first times. I mean, she's topless.
She is.
Which was a big deal.
We had to clear out Savannah for that scene.
I bet you did, right? Holy moly. But, you know, yeah.
And then Kate Blanchett was not yet really known.
Yeah.
No?
I hope that kid gets a break. She deserves it. You know what I mean? But no, it is. It's a crazy cast of people.
Yeah, you had Keanu and, and of course, Hillary.
Mm-hmm. And you played a really layered. I think it was the first time I'd seen you play dark, and again dark, in a way that was really scary because it was real. You know, the scariest people are the ones you know exist.
Right.
And so the idea that he goes out there into the world and can say, "Yeah, I know. Look at me, right? I'm Dudley Do Right, basically. How you doing? Right. Hi there." And then when I'm not doing that, I'm a horrifying and human being.
Well, one of the great things out of that is I have Sam has remained a very, very good friend, and I loved working with him. In fact, I did a show which didn't last more than a minute on Fox, and Sam did the pilot, was a producer on it, and we had, you know, took a swing at that, but we've kept in close touch, and he's a talk about gift. He is an incredibly gifted director. Who is another one of those guys who just knows how to? He has such a gift of working with actors. I mean, he really does. He really wants to. First of all, he's a very good actor himself. Mm. He's done a few
him as an actor.
Yeah, so do I. He's really great, and there's a, you know, to be able to be that means something because he's able to watch actors and you have a great trust with him and he really knows how to get the best out of them.
What's your maybe fondest or happiest memory of working for the great Mike Nichols, which you did with Gary Shandling in What Planet Are You From?
Well, of course, Mike. I had met him over the years and had known him. Him and Diane, who are just lovely, incredibly lovely people. Obviously such a fan, you know, an iconic guy. And I was... you know, thrilled with the opportunity. I had met Gary. Gary and I live not too far from each other and had become kind of friends. And he had written that script along with Peter Tolan. And mm-hmm. and I actually read for that. I went in and read to play that I'm kind of a sleazebag in it, but it was, I was just so excited. I just wanted to work with Mike Nichols. I was just like, whatever. I just want to work with Mike Nichols. Yeah. That needs to happen. I want it to happen. And well, how many times you want me to come back, fellas? I will read these, you know, Perry's, you know,
I'll be the
salacious
dentist.
Lines, whatever you boys want. And, but he was, but obviously Mike is, you know, was a, revered for a reason. It wasn't it. The movie didn't turn out well. You know, it just didn't come together, and it was there was some trouble in making it. Him and Gary had some. They didn't fit, and I don't see how anybody could have ever predicted that because you have two kind of geniuses in their own right.
Yeah.
Two guys who have incredible comedy instincts. Two guys that have, you know. Amazingly successful careers who knew who could really play in different shades, you know. They both had this you know, kind of came to the game with a full deck, and but it was a troubled shoot. I mean, they had some difficulty figuring out how to do the dance together, you know, I wasn't there for the whole shoot, but I know it was a trying one at times. But I like the movie. Mm-hmm. What planet are you from? I like it.
It has some funny stuff in it.
Yeah.
There's no question of that. It's a very uneven movie.
Fair enough. Yes.
But you got to work with people you got to work with.
That's right. Yeah. Now, you've also played real people on a number of occasions.
Mm-hmm.
You played Bob Crane. In Autofocus for Paul Schrader.
Oh,
you
movie.
Played Dick Vermeil in Invincible. And then someone said to you, so you must have picked up the phone, I suppose, one day, and someone said, so what do you think about playing President John F. Kennedy?
Yeah.
And you said who?
We're doing.
Yeah.
And how do you even respond to that, let alone take it on, which you did, and did really, really well.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I was just, I don't know, just stupid enough, once again, to kind of think, I didn't think I could, I don't know, you know, I really was such respect and such a fan of him that, you know, obviously, touching on the subject almost is like climbing a monument. Should you even be up there?
Mm-hmm.
That kind of has changed, and not only for Kennedy, but I mean just generally.
It's yeah, of
like,
course.
It's almost, you know, there used to be much, you know, there were elements working to try to get that after we were done with that show. As
oh,
you'll
sure.
recall, it was supposed to play on
I worked
the
for
History.
Reels Channel
yep.
oh,
okay.
at the time.
So it was supposed to play at the History. So you know, well, the, yeah. you know the story. It was supposed to play on the History Channel. And there were people working to say, oh, you know, all politically aligned to say, oh, no, you can't put the story of John F. Kennedy on it. On a channel that is owned by History, because History is owned by the thing and the other thing and this channel and that channel, and there is money from this person and that person. So we ended up, you know, kind of we were a man without a country for a long while, a few months there, and then Reels was good enough to take us under their wing, and the show, you know, we got nominated, I think 12, 13 Emmys, and it did quite well. But it was just something that didn't want to be touched in terms of its you know distribution,
yeah.
which was killed me. I mean, it really killed me. I was like so. I was angry about it because I didn't feel like it. I felt like whoever was pushing that agenda didn't understand the show because I thought it was such a respectful.
Wait. People you know. Who hadn't seen something were boycotting it?
Yeah. Can you imagine?
Assuming that they knew what it was going to be?
This was back in a crazy time.
I know, right?
That we shall never see again.
Oh.
But it was nuts. So I was really frustrated by that. And I felt like, you know, everybody had, you know, worked so hard to really do something that, listen, it wasn't, I wouldn't say that it was out, it wasn't without showing the faults of the Kennedy family.
Yeah, but it wasn't dirt.
But it wasn't dirt, and no. It wasn't salacious, and it was ultimately, I felt very respectful. So that pissed me off. But but we found a home, and mm-hmm. and ultimately, as an actor, it got seen. And I don't know. I mean, I studied as much as I possibly could. I couldn't have listened to any more tapes or watched any more footage, read any other books about the subject matter of the man I was playing. But at some point you let it go and you see what happened. And, of course there are these affectations of his, in terms of the voice and how Boston do you go and the hair and the and people are obsessed by that stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, you talk about like the detail, the eye for detail. God bless this people in this country. They are watching, man, and they are good at noticing this stuff. And I felt a real obligation to try to get it as right as I could. But at some point, you just kind of say, okay, here it is, and let's go do the best we can.
Well, it's not a caricature. You can't, because then it looks like a caricature.
Yeah.
I always think about Frost Nixon, which is such an incredible film.
Love it.
They didn't have to do anything to Frank Langella to make him look like Nixon.
Right.
They gave him a sweaty upper lip.
Right.
But in general, he looked like Frank Langella, except he's an amazing actor, so he worked as Nixon.
Right.
And to me, I mean, you have a Kennedy-esque look about you. It's not like it's the furthest thing away from something that you could look like. I don't think you need to do a whole lot, but that's such a... It is really tough when everybody wants to break down every piece. And it is Camelot. They are still, this sort of, I won't say untouchable because there have been so many special, every year they're like, I don't know if you all know, but Kennedy was assassinated. I go, stop it. You don't say.
Yeah.
And there's always more specials and more things.
I know. And there always has been.
Yeah.
So it's like, that was another reason why I was frustrated by the distribution of it, just because I felt like, wait a second, what world are you living in?
Well, every film and every show, we know this, is a miracle.
Yeah.
It's a miracle. And that's why, whether it's good or not, we applaud people for just getting something made.
Yeah.
Because it existing and then airing, that's huge. Yeah.
Now, how good are you? This is not a test, a pass-fail test, but how good—
You make me do accents?
No, how
you're gonna
good?
Make the monkey do
no,
a dance.
No, none of that. You don't know what I'm going to ask.
I know you so well, man.
You don't know what I'm going to ask right now of our guest.
I have three daughters, and they always know what I'm about to say, Leonard. I don't know if you're
right
about
that. Well, let's see if this one works out or not.
All right.
How good are you at predicting whether a film is going to be a hit or not, or successful, let's call it. Let's just say successful. Well received.
Well, I've actually seen him sacrifice multiple chickens. Mm. He's very good at this.
That's correct.
It's an art form.
That's correct. It's a gift. Are you talking about my own stuff?
Yeah, I'm talking about when you're making Little Miss Sunshine,
right,
with this great ensemble,
right,
and these two directors, husband and wife directors, Dayton and Farris, who hadn't made a feature film before.
Sure.
And you know you have a great ensemble, but do you know, can you feel as you're making it, this is going to be special?
You know, I've had movies, or shows that I've kind of felt like this is going to be special, and it doesn't, they don't land with an audience, or maybe even don't turn out. But I have to say, more often than not, I don't think I've ever had the experience of being on one where it's all feeling good and everyone's doing their thing. And I'm like thinking, wow, this is good. And it's turned out bad, or just like something I'm like going, what happened here? That has never happened, other than one. I saw a very early cut of Nurse Betty, funny enough,
which is a terrific movie.
I know it is, and Neil LaBute's a friend of mine, and it was the first cut, and it was still finding its way, and it was like, whoa, was a little off, and there was still work to be done on it, and in fact, by the time it was finished, he had turned it into a wonderful film. In fact, I love that movie, so. And it was great to make that film too. Mm-hmm. So that was
another great ensemble.
Yeah, really great. Yeah, we had Chris Rock and Morgan and Renee, who I've worked with a few times, who I adore. So, yeah, I mean, but that's my answer, is that I guess I've had a couple where I thought, this is not going to be great. And I have been surprised by not maybe greatness, mm-hmm. but they have either found an audience and gotten some reviews. And I've been like, oh, look at that. I don't know anything.
A film I like, but I understand why it was tough to find an audience, is Fast Food Nation.
Yeah.
Rick Linklater's take on the – it's really a nonfiction book.
Right.
That he dramatized.
Right.
And I thought he did a good job of it, too.
Yeah.
And you're all good in it.
I think Rick knows what he's getting into. Mr. Linklater's aware that he doesn't necessarily make a Transformers movie.
Right. I've done two movies with Rick, and that was was great fun. Actually, we went to Cannes with it and had a wonderful response there. I didn't watch that and think, oh well, this is gonna light the multiplex up. But I do agree with you that Eric Schlosser's book, Fast Food Nation, which I just gave to my 15-year-old daughter, and said, "Wow, read this book," because she's a book addict. It's an incredible book about the industrial, complex of the fast food industry, mm-hmm. and all its tentacles and what it does. And to turn that into a narrative story, that documentary, they've done a million of those.
Right.
It's the easy shot. It's I get it. You know, you go show some cows being slaughtered and you show people being, whatever. But this version of his, of trying to tell a true narrative story about what was happening and how big of a problem it was a very big undertaking, and only Rick could have done it. And I like the film.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do too.
Yeah.
I don't know if I want to see it on a regular basis.
Right. Right.
Okay.
We won't turn that into a series. That'll be the last movie we don't turn into a series. This week, French fries.
Yeah, right. You know, everything you're eating, it's going to kill you. Congratulations.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I have to – Jesse gets annoyed with me when I go jumping all over the map. Chronologically, he said, flubbing a word.
Why do you like to stay linear and he likes to jump around?
You know, I don't always know what the hell he's talking about, but I kind of just let it go. Again, you have daughters. How old are your girls?
They are 15, 13, and 9.
Mm-hmm. Oi.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. Thank you for the oi. I'll take your oi and raise you an oi.
You know what I'm saying? I just
and I'm not even Jewish.
That's it, right? I just turned 33.
Yeah.
I think I'm less of a pain in the ass now.
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah, that was too long. You took too long on that one.
Yeah, yeah.
You jump all over. Yeah. You enjoy
But when he
yourself.
Did go to yeah, he gave you like six of them.
Yeah. He's terrified.
Oh, yeah.
He understands what will happen.
Sure he does.
I am just so fascinated. You have about four films completed that are not yet released. Mm. And one of them is called Misbehavior.
Right.
And you play Bob Hope.
I do.
Tell us about
You may that. Not know this, but he's a huge Bob Hope fan.
Oh, you are.
Yeah. Oh, we love anything like that.
No, it's a wonderful story. Basically tells the story of kind of the beginning of the women's movement in 1970 in mm-hmm. England. And you find Keira Knightley, a young lawyer, kind of dealing with the man world of the man ensconced world of becoming a lawyer. Who gets mixed up with these women who are looking to protest? They're just at that stage where it's like they're protesting. They want a voice. Meanwhile, you're tracking the story of Bob and Dolores Hope, played mm-hmm. by Leslie Manville, and we are in Palm Springs, California, and Bob is being asked once again, because he had hosted the Miss World pageant a few years back, to come and do it again. And Dolores is none too happy about that. Don't know how good your research is, Leonard. But he ends up taking the job, and she goes with him to London.
That can only end well.
That can only end well. Yeah. They go to London to host the Miss World pageant, which was a huge event. I mean, it was seen by, I think, 100 million people, more people than walked on the moon at the time. And it's just a massive production done at Wembley Hall or Royal Albert Hall or something, and Royal Albert. And then we get over there, and this group of protesters end up disrupting the event, and chaos ensues. So that's kind of the story. It's a wonderful script. Philippa Lowenthorpe directed it, and she did it seemed like a great job. I mean, it was really fun to do. I was first had to find a little. We had to work on the nose.
I was
going to
say, did you prosthetic? Yeah.
In fact, I hadn't gone over there yet, and I called and I said, you know, can we get a head start on this and maybe look at a nose? And we had a wonderful guy here in Los Angeles who kind of started a prosthetic, which saved us a lot of time. So see, I am getting smarter. And we added a little chin piece. So by the time we got to London, we were. You know, on
your
the,
face
we
was
were on the
ready.
10 yard. We were on the 10 yard line. We still had a little work to do. But the look and the clothes. They had a wonderful costumer. They got the whole thing down, and it was great fun. I mean, again, that's kind of a larger than life guy. There's, you know, some wonderful films of his that I hadn't seen before that I, you know, kind of drilled down on. There's some great interviews of Bob, one in particular, for all you Bob Hope fans out there, Dick Cavett talks to him for about an hour and 5 minutes on YouTube, which is a pretty fun little interview. But the tone of him, the sound of him, you know, I can't do it. I can't go right into character and work and do my monkey act for you, Leonard. But there's a sound
did I ask,
that he had.
Did I ask? Let the record show. I did not ask you.
He's holding a knife. He's holding a knife to me right now. There's a an ah sound that,
yes.
that would come out. And so tried to get it as right as I could. It was fun to do. Don't expect to see Bob Hope, but I think we got a good little guy there that'll feel well and feel right, and I think it'll fit the story. But I haven't seen the movie. I have no idea. Mm-hmm. Terrified. Who wants to play Bob Hope? We do the USO show. I started
really?
The USO shows.
Oh, wow.
And then, you know, he's in Palm Springs, and then he's on the plane over to London.
Oh,
then he's
my.
Hosting the event that goes wrong.
My.
The event ended in, you know, flower bombs and chaos from the audience. I mean, it was a crazy outcome, but it was great fun to do.
Oh, sounds really interesting.
Yeah, it'll be. I think it'll be good.
And it's called Misbehavior.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
And the people who did, you know, The Crown, actually, or the you know, worked on it, or the producers of it. So we have some good people and wonderful actors involved, and we'll see.
Well.
Cross your fingers, then.
So you're a big Bob Hope fan.
Oh,
did you ever?
I am.
Yeah.
No, I did get to meet him on a number of occasions,
I never met Bob.
I grew up in Toluca Lake, and his house was up the street from our house.
Yeah.
So we went there for Halloween.
Oh, my God.
They used to come out. He and Dolores used to come out and take photos with the kids.
Oh,
but also,
my gosh.
They'd give out stuff with his face on, with the caricature, the famous caricature on it.
Yeah. We have a Bob Hope kazoo.
I have a Pez Bob dispenser.
Paddle ball,
mask, all this stuff. My parents going, Jesse, forget candy. Just go straight to Bob Hope's house.
Go to the Hopes.
And I'm like 6 years old going, why? Just go straight to Bob Hope's house.
Well, he just was such a showman, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just had such a wonderful presence about him. And that's a hard thing, you know, just creating presence is the most daunting thing to be asked to do in the world, because he's Bob Hope because he's Bob Hope.
Yeah.
I'm not.
But at the same time, JFK.
Yeah.
You know, you have an icon, a person who's an icon, and as you say, the voice. Yeah. That Boston accent, man, that's any version of it is slightly complicated. That and Maryland/Delaware.
Yeah.
I don't know how anybody does that. But it's, you know, Okay, you don't want to sound ridiculous.
Right.
You don't want to sound, park the car and have it. Yeah, you don't want to be that guy.
Right.
But you also need to sound like he sounds.
Correct. It's,
have you, did you ever take voice lessons?
I have.
I'm sure you have a vocal coach.
Yeah,
did you ever?
I've had a, had a coach actually for this, yeah. actually for the, for misbehavior. And very helpful. I mean, yeah. it's very helpful to have somebody outside of yourself. Mm-hmm. It's like being directed outside of yourself, who's able to kind of work with you on sounds and things. So it's really important.
It is. It's the sense. There are people like Patton Oswalt, folks like that, who can just go into all these different kinds of accents, and they always say they find a key. It's that
right.
thing. They
right.
find
it's
a whatever
a
it is.
Oh,
ah, yeah. okay, that's yeah. the sound. I'm tricked. Got it. I'm
absolutely.
In it. You know, which is why doing it right now is not easy.
Right.
Because to just 1, 2, 3 get into it, you know, doesn't brain doesn't necessarily
like
work like that.
Like a trained monkey.
Like a beautiful trained monkey. Now, dare I ask, do your kids want to be actors?
That's a fine question to ask because
it seems to happen.
I would say certainly the first two have no interest whatsoever.
Congratulations.
Thank you. The third is a. We'll see. She's 9. She is, you know, has wonderful instincts and has a great sense of a moment and how to play it. But actor, I don't know. I at this not certainly not at this age. You know, none of them have asked to go on commercial auditions or anything of
Mazel
that
tov.
Nature. Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, thanks.
Now, have you gotten a lot of feedback? You've done some television, some what we now call high-end television.
Yeah.
You Fancy played, TV.
You played yourself on The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt for a couple of episodes.
Yeah,
what
fun.
Were you like?
Yes.
How did you find
yeah.
you?
Yeah, no, it was not easy.
And then you were on the last season of House of Cards.
Yes.
And with Diane Lane.
Mm-hmm.
And Robin Wright and those other folks, have you gotten like do people stop you in airports and hotel lobbies and on the street? Do you get feedback that
he always
you don't
wants to
get
know
from movies?
What someone recognizes you from?
Oh, I see.
I'll help. Here's what he wants.
Right, right. You'd be amazed how much talk soup apparently.
Yeah,
I still remember. From,
Man, I did grow up with that. That
yeah.
was a big thing.
Yeah. But I would say, I would say that television certainly, you know, has a wider net. But I don't know. For me, honestly, I get a lot of, oh, hi, can I get a picture? And then the husband's like, who is it, honey? And they're like, I'm
like,
sure,
Dennis
but he's
Quaid.
Been in that thing, and then he was in that thing, and that thing. They don't quite know
yeah.
exactly
yeah.
who. So it's... It's a perfect amount of fame. I'm the
yeah.
light beer of fame. All of the perks and half of the atrocities.
Yeah.
Well, you're not a chameleon. You're not somebody who drastically changes his appearance from one role to another.
Who is?
Billy Crudup. No one can ever recognize that guy.
No. Oh. I did a movie.
People
with
don't
Billy.
Recognize. Do you, are you sure?
Maybe.
Because it could have been someone else.
That explains it. That explains it.
He and Aaron Eckhart, I have learned, everyone's like, I think I know who they are.
Right.
I think I've seen them in things. Cannot go further than that. They get all confused.
Right.
Because they
right.
do look, whether it's shaggy hair, things like that.
Right.
It's, we have not That's yet seen your Manson look.
Right.
That's you know, true. We no, grow it
true.
Out, get real gruff.
That is true. That's true.
But you do get recognized because you have now been in this game for a while.
Yeah.
And even I was kind of taken aback when I saw how many feature film credits you've amassed.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of really good films, too. I mean, your batting average is pretty high.
Nice Thank batting you. Average.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
And I would add Phil to that. Tell us about Brian Banks. That's your other film coming up this summer.
Yeah.
And a friend of ours has already seen it and was saying good stuff about it the other night.
It's a great film, I think. It comes out August 9th. Tom Shadyac directed it,
mm-hmm.
who you know and have spoken to, I'm sure,
mm-hmm.
over the years. And, you know, you don't think of the guy who directed Liar Liar as a guy to do a very serious drama, but he did a fantastic job, knew the story he wanted to tell. And the story is, you know, Brian, you know, real life guy, young guy who was in high school down in Long Beach,
You know, very tough life, you know, raised by a single mom, and he was falsely accused of raping a young woman and ended up in prison. You know, he took a plea and bargain, and he got the book thrown at him for 7 years in prison. Not much of a bargain. And he came out of prison and actually was contacted by the girl, and turns out that you know, that this was a real injustice that had happened in his life, and especially in the, you know, current climate, it's a tricky subject to talk about. But you know, he had this guy Justin Brooks, who is the head of the California Innocence Project, who I play, basically consider the case. Justin works with a number of young aspiring law students, and they met Brian and were so taken with him. They felt like, you know, listen, this is worth taking. Even though what they normally do in the CIP is take people who are wrongly incarcerated,
and they try to help them
and
get
they,
out. Yeah.
They've exonerated, you know, 30 people or 35 people who are literally in prison for tens of years of their life, and then one day they're out through this organization. Justin's never taken a dime from the organization. He heard this case, and it was a little outside the zone of what they do because Brian's already out.
Yeah,
but he's wearing an ankle bracelet. He's not allowed to go near a field. He wants to reinstate his football career.
You have
to register a sex offender. So they end up taking the case and end up, you know, basically getting the case overturned with very little time left on the clock. And you know, Brian, who always had aspirations for playing in the NFL, actually went on and did play with the Atlanta Falcons, you know, which was very brief, unfortunately. I would like that to have been a longer, you know, obviously for the story, you want that to be a different ending, like a longer NFL career. But the point is, he's an incredibly special guy who has an incredibly positive attitude. He's went up through a hell of a lot, came back to the other side, and has really shown what perseverance is about. And he ultimately, more than anything, advocated for himself and saved himself. And he's just a special guy. And this story kind of tells you all of that. And I thought, I think it's terrific.
I look forward to that one. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I see by the old clock on the wall, we don't have a clock.
We should get a clock on here. Just so that when you make that thing, it'll be okay.
I see by the old clock on the wall.
On the table.
That it's time for us to wrap this. But thank you so much for coming by today, Greg.
Thank you. It was great to come by and talk to you about all this.
And continued success to you.
Thank you.
I mean, I didn't mention the other 14 films that
there's another. Okay,
in the bullpen waiting to be released, because you've got a lot of stuff.
Well, you know, it's really after that directing thing kind of had me just disappear. It took some time, and then all of a sudden after that, I started to do some stuff again, and so it's finally starting, I guess, is coming out. But, you know, you never can time this stuff. Seems to, like, come at the same, you know, the fill is July 5th, and then I think at the end of the month is this Netflix thing called Red Sea Diving Resort. Brian Banks is August 9th. Honestly, I never would have planned it that way. That's way too much Greg Kinnear for anybody.
I
apologize.
It's the year of Kinnear, and it's just too easy, and I'm sorry. I'm honestly sorry, but I did
it. You had to.
Yeah, now, if you could, since you have 17 other movies that we could talk, is there anything that you would love to tell people about that you feel like didn't get enough attention, or do you have a favorite film of yours that you want to share?
The last thing I'll say is just that I had done this movie with Ira Sachs, who I made a movie with called Little Men, which I love. He's a filmmaker out of...
It's a lovely film.
Out of Brooklyn. Yeah. And he is really a gifted filmmaker. And he made this movie called Frankie. And I played at the Cannes this year in competition. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to make it over there. But it's a cool little film. And I just... Shout out to my friend Ira, because he's a great filmmaker, and the kind of filmmaker who would love this show, because you guys talk about film, and he would, and I think he would be very vocal about the issue we were talking about of seeing a movie in a theater. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think a lot of young directors are like, I don't know. And they watch it on their phone, their iPad, whatever, you know. And he still recognizes the value of that experience and has taken, you know, there's been shortcuts that he could have taken to do things where it would have played. And I think he's really a champion of film, and we need those people out there that are still wanting to play it in a cinema.
Good for him and good for you.
Yep, thank you.
Frankie.
Are you a social media person?
I have a 0 footprint, although I was just at the talk today and they told me that there's a fake Greg Kinnear account and I had to read tweets from my fake account. I was like, you know, those are as good as I would have done.
Right?
So, yeah.
There's an account, Angry Leonard Maltin. That's one of my favorites.
Yeah, there you go.
But it's actually just my dad, but it's his honest reviews.
Yeah.
That would be the real,
That'd be a great punchline.
I have terrible ideas now.
No, don't do that. Don't even go there.
Year of Kinnear.
There's no Greg Kinnear with a check mark next to it anywhere.
You're not verified.
You're not verified. No.
As the kids
I know, say. I know. You know what? I don't know how that happened. Honestly, I don't know where the last 20 years went.
You have three kids,
man. How the hell did we get into the place where everybody has I just never did it, and damn it, I'm sticking by it.
We are not.
Okay.
We, however, being out there
I can't wait to see where you go with it.
I don't have anywhere to go. I just need you to do the plug.
You're welcome. I am at Jesse Maltin. You are at Leonard Maltin on Twitter and Instagram. And you can go to leonardmaltin.com for movie reviews and book roundups and all kinds of good stuff.
Oh, that's true. And we have merch to boot.
We do have merch. Adorable little Leonard's face can be yours.
And yours.
Yeah, but yours is cuter.
I doubt that.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Greg. And thank you, folks, for listening. We'll see you next time. Maltin on Movies is sponsored today by Legion M, the first fan-owned entertainment company. They've got a lot of good stuff going on, and you can learn about it at legionm.com.